Welcome to Influential Visions. Here we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. Here is your host, Nathaniel Schooler.
I'm very, very privileged today because I am joined by Jude Pullen, who has joined me. I was in a bit of a rush to find an amazing guest, and as he's been a guest before on Influential Visions, I thought that I would ask him, and he gladly agreed. And so I'm going to read out a little bit about him before we get stuck into this interview, because he's very, very interesting. He's basically been on the BBC, two documentary, Big Life Fix, and he's also the winner of the 2020 IMEC Institute of Mechanical Engineers, Alistair Graham Bryce Imagineering Award. And Jude is a creative technologist who's very sought after, and he offers creative and thought-provoking solutions for complex challenges. He's worked with NHS, Dyson, Lego, loads of startups. His clients are IKEA, RS Components, Children in Need, Raspberry Pi, and his TV appearances also include Channel 4's Great British Inventions. So I could carry on reading lots and lots more here, but I'm not going to. I think we'll have a really interesting conversation as we always do, and thank you, Jude. I greatly appreciate you joining me, and looking forward to having a conversation about the future, really. And that's what this series is all about. And I know you're big into product design, you're big into sustainability, and you know, I'm kind of a bit miffed because I typed into Gemini some questions, and I said, because I left it in a bit of a last minute thing. I was thinking about this interview for 3-4 days, and I was like, what can I ask this guy that's going to be different to what everyone else asks him, right? And we exchanged a couple of LinkedIn messages, and I was like, God, I better get this right or the guy's going to like kill me. So literally, as I usually do, I leave these things till last minute. And I went to Google Gemini and I said, give me some questions. And Google Gemini gave me some questions for Jude. I basically put in there what I think Jude is. I said, basically just give me three questions, for an amazing product designer, innovator on an interview about the future. And I was thinking, oh, great. Gemini is going to spit out the most amazing questions, but no. Gemini spat out three paragraphs of stuff that I really didn't want to read at all, which probably by the time I got to the end of the questions, I would have forgotten the question, and he would probably forgotten the question because it had three questions in one. So I thought, right, now give me three simple questions. So then it gave us three simple questions, which are not simple. So I have modified, we've talked about it before we jumped on here, and I've modified these questions, and Jude knows the questions. So he's happy, I'm happy. And I have decided that looking ahead 10 years, what do you see is the best question for me. So what do you think, like in terms of product design and innovation, yeah, like, and technology and the world that we're going to see, what do you think in 10 years it's going to be like?
So yeah, I think 10 years is always one of those weird things. Like if you get asked, like, what do you think you're going to be doing in 10 years in terms of your career or your personal life? I think it's almost telling the fact that we nearly always get it completely wrong, right? So, you know, if you'd asked me at a certain point in my life, would I be married to someone who I met in Hong Kong and, you know, have a kid and be doing this line of work? It's literally been, I started off in chemistry and was in Newcastle and grew up in the country and didn't really have any idea of even what design was. So I kind of think, not to evade the question, but I think Kevin Kelly's book, The Inevitable, actually says this in a more business language, that essentially the thing you have to realize is separating between what is, as he calls it, inevitable, and what is extremely hard to predict in terms of its granularity. And the example he gives is how you can't predict the iPhone, but you could say that it was inevitable that telecommunications would become you know, more widespread, more omnipresent, more integrated into our lives, miniaturized and cheaper, all of those things, you can expect that trend, right? And so I think when you say the sort of 10-year thing, I can't tell you whether it's going to be ChatGPT or whether Rabbit AI, the little orange mini thing that's doing the rounds on social media right now, which of those things are going to be the most influential. And by influential, I don't mean that they have to be the thing, but do they trigger a next leap? I'd find it very hard to predict that. But what I can say seems inevitable is the idea that our brains are going to be augmented by increasing levels of essentially input from effectively a global hive mind. So, you know, a good example of this is how many people's phone numbers have you actually committed to your memory? I only know my wife's for like flat out emergencies, but I've forgotten everyone else. Whereas if you ask me when I was 18, I remembered like dozens of my friends' numbers. So I think the cognitive load of memorizing stuff is going to rapidly fall away. And what is going to reside, what is going to be left, is essentially, I think our humanity will be defined with what we do with those fragments of data. And at the minute, I would take quite a perhaps contrary view that I don't think AI is actually showing any great leaps in creativity or purpose or understanding why we do what we do or what our humanity is, but it's a catalyst. And the definition of a catalyst is it accelerates a thing that already is there. It doesn't just magic stuff out of thin air. So I think for me, you know, it's like the Steve Jobs quote of, you know, computers are a bicycle for the mind. You know, perhaps AI is the motorbike for the mind, if you know what I mean. It's bolting on something that'll go even faster. But to use that metaphor, maybe to overuse it, you still got to decide what road trip you're going on, mate. You know, it's not going to tell you.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
I don't know that people in the audience are thinking, but I could ask it to recommend a really nice thing through the Napa Valley. You're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. But you know what I'm saying with the metaphor is you still have to be the, you know, the captain of your ship, ultimately. I don't think we should trust that to the AI. Otherwise, I think you end up at Gattaca if you've seen that film.
I haven't seen that.
Would be Wall-E, where they all go up to the ship.
but it's interesting when you look at the way that kind of items are being used these days, and how, like, if something breaks, I mean, I mentioned to you before, like, I've been thinking about this for years, like how, like, companies like IKEA and big companies who make lots and lots of products are going to be able to just have a 3D printer. Maybe Amazon will be the pioneer in that. They have a 3D printer that literally just prints pretty much any part that you need. Say you break a part on your Hoover, or, you know, on your chair, or whatever it is, there'll be certain manufacturers that actually just license these items to said company, probably Amazon, because they seem to be investing more than any other company in the world in terms of innovation budget per net profit or whatever it is. So you're going to have these kind of localized delivery hubs for these things that you need, in my mind. But I'm sort of thinking, I mean, the sky's the limit, isn't it, really? If you can imagine it, you can probably end up doing it, right? Would you sort of think that is a good way to kind of look at it?
I guess one of the things, having followed the 3D printer revolution, in air quotes, you know, for anyone listening to this, is I would say there is a lot of hype in this, but that doesn't mean that there isn't the sort of kernel, the seeds of something that will actually build to be quite profound and influential. So I guess to give some substance to that, I think what I found, and you can see this whether you go to schools, universities, or just people's homes, having a 3D printer, the blunt truth is, it does not make you a designer any more than me rocking up to your house and going, here's a canvas, some oil paints and paintbrushes, away you go with the next Mona Lisa. And so it's not that I'm being defensive or intimidated, but I think that I still hold the fact that I went to university and I trained for a considerable amount of time in the craft of what it is to design a good product. I think it'd be disingenuous to say that that doesn't give me any extra skills to bear than someone who just is rocking up to using, you know, sort of KiCad or Tinkercad or some free software and thinks they want to design a product from scratch to go on Dragon's Den. It's not to say that you can't have an outlier. You absolutely can. But I'm just being honest that certain things require a degree of expertise and a degree of understanding of the holistic things that go together. But having said that, do I think that 3D printers will inspire a sense of the art of the possible, as they say, of that people, you know, kids especially, will grow up in a world where it's not weird to design something at home, bring it into school, print it at school, or to take it to a sort of 3D printing hub, and for not much money than would be comparable to anything else they would spend their pocket money on, or that their parents would consider valuable education. I think these sorts of things will become more ubiquitous. But I think all I was just trying to caveat it is that I think, like my metaphor with painting, you still need to put a degree of sweat and grind into actually getting good at it. You know, I guess it's the same, like they, you know, the phrase they say, everyone can draw, everyone can sing. Yes, that is true, but to reach a sort of proficient level where you could call it good enough to draw an income from, that I think it's very obvious that the whether it's gone for education or it's just sweat and grind, the point is you're still putting the time in. So I think that will hold true is the thing I would say, but that's not through a fear of being undercut by people doing awesome magic. And I do think there will be AI things that you don't have to be a master of computer aided design. It will give you great shortcuts, really powerful accelerating tools. But back to my point about catalysis, it will accelerate your ability to do things, but you've still got to figure out whether something's worth inventing in the first place, because a chocolate fire guard is still a stupid idea. Whether you did it in 3 hours as opposed to 30 hours isn't really the crux, is it?
Agreed. Yeah, I agree 100%. I was literally just talking with Michael Tobin, OBE, last week about yeah. this very thing, and he was sort of saying that that basically, like, a lot of things have been invented already, and it's just the matter of actually just putting the pieces together. But actually, a human who is at one with the technology is always going to be far ahead, and then the technology needs direction. Like, it needs direction, and that's the whole point of the AI Act that's come into Europe that will take years to implement. It's the whole point of safeguarding this for the future of society, right, and the future of people. Mm-hmm. But leading on a little bit from my question, what emerging technology are you most excited about, apart from 3D printing? We can't talk about that now.
Yeah, no, I think I see 3D printing as just another tool, but maybe that's an interesting springboard to say that I think a more impactful tool is going to be the, you know, the introduction of AI, as I mentioned, into our lives. And I don't think I'd be saying anything to your audience that isn't already available on many blogs or, you know, other good informed sources. But I think this idea of, I like this phrase that I often used when I was at Lego, of gradually then suddenly. And I forget who coined the phrase, I should have been more prepared. But I like the fact that it really sums up this feeling of suddenly the future's arrived and it's all around us. And how did that happen? And it's almost as if we have to retrospectively point out, you do realize even your washing machine has AI in it. You know, I haven't even spent a lot of time analyzing my washing machine, but it does a little shimmy before it starts. And that's because it weighs the amount of clothing in there and then decides how it's going to calibrate it and balance it. So is that AI, or is that just smart automation? you know, so for me, those lines of sort of fuzziness, I think that's often why you have this gradually then suddenly feeling, is that it almost needs this big sudden shock to say, we've just figured out how to screen for breast cancer using AI imagery and all this sort of stuff. And then people go, wow, that's amazing. But if you speak to someone who's in, you know, sort of a med tech environment, they're like, well, we've been scanning stuff and looking for these features for years. It's just we didn't run it through a massive, big cluster computer or something like this. But we have been always encroaching on these ideas of using an accelerant that is computing. So I guess, you know, the thing that I think is going to be really the thing that will probably be the biggest shock, I think, is going to be the what you could call biometrics, you know. And so this idea that, you know, when I look at products like Apple or Nike and the sort of smartwatches, when you consider that you've got something on your wrist with an Apple Watch that isn't just detecting your pulse, it's also doing something called pulse oximetry, which is the amount of oxygen in your blood. And that in its own is a bit of a vague thing, but that combined with all the other totality of the data that your phone, your laptop, your smartwatch, let's say it is the Vision Pro, all of those things combined, it's a staggering amount of information that a company is now gleaning. And even, you know, I often tell people this, that they probably wouldn't realize that when they've got AirPods, the little in-ear headphones, they have a temperature sensor. And I don't know whether you've ever remembered being to the doctors, they often take your temperature in your ear. So you might be listening to some music, but Apple is capable of going, wow, your temperature just went up a fraction of degree. That's interesting. I wonder what that correlates to. And, oh, I've just noticed your pulse oximetry has changed and your heart rate, and we're tracking your eyes, and. So you can see what I'm saying is that there will be a gradually then suddenly shock when I think Apple is doing this already, and it's not to imply any nefarious sort of, you know, maniacal cackles from behind the scenes. I think all technology companies are moving in this direction. But the moment when they choose to educate the consumer that this isn't something you should fear, but it's something that is bringing so many great benefits to you, that you essentially go, oh, it's okay, I don't mind a bit of biometrics. And I think we've seen this on social media, where it doesn't matter how many people like me or some of the people I'm sure you've interviewed are going, whoa, easy, read the terms and conditions, do not install that app, it's not a good idea, because there's so much sizzle to that thing that they're selling, people still sign up to it. And I think it's, you know, dare I say it, that's where you start to get into ethics of a brand, of whether they are playing a short-term game or a long-term game. And I do think, I could be wrong, I hope I'm not, but I do think Apple is trying to play a long game, in that it doesn't actually just want to scalp the data of a generation, sell it for the most amount of money, and then close shop. Do I think some other companies, so I'm not going to necessarily say, but do I think some companies are doing that? Absolutely. But the notion that a company could track not just my data and my life, but my children's, my partner's, my friends, it gets to the point where the totality of that is a recommendation engine, the likes of which would probably break our minds today. And I do think that sort of thing isn't technologically hard to get there in 10 years. I think it's cognitively hard for us to get there in 10 years. I suspect there are plenty of people in all these companies which are going, we could totally do that in 10 years, technologically speaking. But there'll be someone in the company going, but it's going to blow their minds. They won't cope. They will not cope with the idea that we know what they're going to eat for breakfast all the way through to we've got a pretty high probability on who they're going to marry, or if they marry at all, you know, or where they're likely to live. And I think those sorts of things seem absolutely terrifying to people at the minute. Yet if you look at some more mundane experiences, I bought a Peugeot as my first car. My dad drove a Peugeot. Do I really believe it was such a sort of like strong choice of mine, or did I just follow a linearity of the fact that I get on well with my dad, so I didn't rebel? If I hated my dad, maybe I would have got an Audi or something else to sort of kick against it. But I think to a computer, we are just an apple that falls a little distance away from a tree that it has already mapped. Do you see what I mean? So I think we'd like to think of ourselves as completely staggeringly individual, but actually we're products of our families, our connections, our networks, our cultures and the companies we work at. When those things start to coalesce, and sure, some people might be thinking, oh, but it's not like that in the UK because of GDPR and things like this. And you go, try China. Vast amounts of data are run through the government. And that's not to, you know, become paranoid about China. It's just to say it's a different paradigm. And I think the West may want to scaremonger about these things, but it might end up actually following suit because it has to, because otherwise it loses the race. And so I think, you know, if you really ask me about the 10 years thing, I think the equivalent of an arms race of AI is the thing I hope governments try to make it less adversarial and more in the spirit of, say, what we actually learned from COVID is that should we put the weapons down and actually work on the bigger things of humanity rather than to do the AI equivalent of, you know, mess each other up, to use gentle language, you know. But I think those are the sort of things which I'm trying to get a handle on in terms of the companies I work with, is A, that thing about what is inevitable, even if you can't predict the granularity, but also what are some of the ethics you should strive for today so that you don't have to do a hard pivot in 10 years' time because you're in completely the wrong area. And I do think, to Kevin Kelly's point, it's easier to predict ethics than it is to predict the widget. I can't predict the widget. It's like I just can't. But I do think discussing things like biometrics, our personal data, how connected all of these things are, out of that morass starts to develop a sort of a North Star, depending on which brand I'm working with. And I see that time and time again, that actually people within a company, if you ask them to describe where they think they should be, they actually have a pretty good understanding of where the conscience of the company actually has to exist. And I think that's actually what makes me a technology optimist, is most people recognize dystopia. You know, and I'm slightly plagiarizing Charlie Brooker, that I saw him speak at the O2, and he said, What actually helps me sleep at night is that everybody is shocked by the things I create and goes, oh my God, I wouldn't want that. And he's like, brilliant. Until you stop saying that, I know that we're all right, you know. So weirdly, that's why I see technology as something to be played with, understood, but still ethically trying to project as well. Sorry, long answer to that question, Matt.
No, it's good. It's a good answer. I'm just nodding away, absorbing what you're saying. I mean, we share that technology optimist attitude, actually. That's one of the reasons that I'm interviewing you, because we have a similar mindset. We want people to succeed and all of that sort of good stuff, right? But like, I mean, I know we talked a little bit about hydrogen and off-grid living and stuff like that. I mean, what do you think on those two topics? Do you think hydrogen is going to be a new fuel for transport, or do you think it's not so much?
Yeah, I'll answer that question in a second, but I think this is where it'll be interesting if you imagine disruptive technology, is whether an AI has been listening to everything I've said, and then it tees you up a slightly more better segued question, because it's a bit of a hard turn
to go,
you know. It was a question that you had on the script, and so it'll be interesting to almost say, could Gemini be a side companion to you, and saying, based on what Jude said, this is how we weave in the next strand. And so I think, you know, and this isn't me to mock your interviewing style, it's just saying that's the sort of thing I think AI will actually finesse, just to give in the moment example. And so again, I'm now sort of trying to be the AI for myself, of going, how do you segue from AI into sustainable energy. And I guess actually I have a really nice segue in that part of my work at the minute is working with 7 startups with the Design Council on their net zero journey. So these are all companies that are looking at how do we sort of disrupt or improve the net zero offerings. And mm-hmm. I obviously can't talk specifics, but there's one company is working with wind farms and the generation of electricity from wind and other things in particular. But what's rather fascinating about that is that I had always thought, oh yeah, you put a turbine up, away you go. But actually the huge part of their business is focused on something as prosaic as how do you connect the cables up with the minimum amount of distance, but then also how do you overlay statistical probabilities that you will have to perform maintenance on these things? And if you have something go wrong, does it mean you knock out 10 things that were downwind of that? Or how do you create this? If you've ever seen Terminator, you know, where he gets stabbed with the bar and then he has a little moment going rerouting and he has to figure mm-hmm. out how to power himself, even though he's lost a load of things. I'd say that's almost the you know, they might not thank me for using that metaphor, but it feels like that's the sort of redundancy model, to use the engineering term, a sort of backup that these huge systems around sustainability need, is that they actually need to mature in the way that, you know, gas and oil and all of these things have had decades of investment and fine-tuning things. And actually, we're really at the beginning. So it sometimes irritates me when people bring out statistics and go, oh, you know, the problem with renewables is this, this, this. And you go, this is still a baby. This is still, and also when you look at the curves of like how fast, you know, photovoltaics have been improving, I feel there's almost a Moore's law equivalent of that they're accelerating at an absolutely phenomenal rate. But to sort of put a bead on it and do a calculation today, when, to your point about 10 years, these things are going to be in a different league. But one of the things that's going to underpin that different league is also the politics. And maybe one of the most influential books, and to try and still answer this question about renewables, is zooming out to what are renewables made from, be it the lithium that makes batteries, be it the copper that connects all these things, and so on and so on. A terrific book I've read and I've recommended to quite a few companies I've spoke to is Ed Conway's Material World. And what I love about his approach is that he's taken 6 minerals from around the world. And rather than sort of harp on about how there's scarcity and blah, 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 which I think people will sort of get bored of very quickly, he takes a very geopolitical approach. And one of the most surprising things of the read that I sort of didn't expect would come out is that he was, and you know, I don't want to sort of mash his words too much here, but I took away actually a sense of optimism that because our geopolitics and trade and tech sharing are so hyper-connected, it's actually going to be quite difficult for us to just flip a switch and have World War III. You know, and a case in point he makes without getting too contentious is that a vast number of China's AI chips are manufactured in Taiwan, which means it's not a great idea as much as there is well-documented, you know, political tension between Taiwan and China, which we don't need to get into. But the point is, it's not really a great move to go bomb the heck out of Taiwan. And then when you read that Apple has a vast amount of its silicon tied up in Taiwan, chances are America's not just going to be cool about this. But then what's interesting is part of the things that enable Taiwan to make the best chips of its kind in the world, they need to buy very, very specific things that are only available at the minute in a mine in America. And in order to get that stuff out of the mine refined to a certain thing, I forget where it was, but they have to get something from like Chile or Germany or something like this. But the point is, the web is so massively interconnected. The idea that you can just rock up and have world domination just actually seems so laughable. that almost, dare I say it, our technological complexity might be a new form of galvanization that we have to work together. And just to say, for anyone sort of pointing out the very obvious conflicts that have been happening at the in recent years, I was trying to make the distinction between a world war, essentially that vast conquering, versus ultimately relatively small, you know, maneuvers. Not to diminish or undermine anything by that statement, but I hope we can agree on there's a difference between the world war and, you know, the Ukrainian war. So I hope, you know, and again, I'm not a geopolitical specialist, but I did take from this book a very interesting take of how fragile this ecosystem is. And I hope that that almost leads towards a more responsible political oversight of different countries. And to get back to this point about sustainability, I use the word fragile deliberately to make the point about our fragile ecosystem, that again, it's not good enough to just kick out a load of toxic chemicals into the ocean, because it's going to mess the ocean up for everyone. So again, I think there's something really, I hope, you know, enlightening about companies and countries taking responsibility for the circularity. I think the circularity means companies can't just say, well, we've created a product, we've birthed it into this world, and it doesn't matter what happens next. I think circularity, we could look back on it, and it could be one of the most profound influences on our humanity and our relationship with the planet, not because it's about virtue signaling, but because it forces our economics to have to be essentially self-sufficient and interconnected in a way that at the minute they're not even remotely close to. And so I think it feels very early to say, you know, circularity is our salvation, because, you know, I might be dead in the ground before we actually achieve it. But I think we might look back on it and say that was when we stopped just making stuff and then chucking it away. And we understood that that is a finite thing that we have to reconnect. So, yeah, I sort of, you know, I just read a book by Chris Dixon called Read, Write, Own. And he has, sorry to spoil it, but he closes it, a statement with the end that says, these are the good old days. And I think that's such a lovely turn of phrase that we are going to look back and go, this is the moment when actually we really were able to realize all these things. So this is why I think it's one of the most exciting times to be invested in not just technology for technology's sake, but technology with a view to what does it mean for our humanity and longevity.
Absolutely. And if Google Gemini had realized you would never get to three questions, it would have only given me two, you see, if it had actually thought about it.
Can I get a word in edgeways, Jude? God's sake.
But I didn't, I don't need to. I actually agree with pretty much everything you said there, to be honest. And I think that it is an exciting time to be alive. I think anyone that is listening to this might be worried about technology. They might be, you know, stressed about it and everything else. We need Luddites, because Luddites actually slow down things, and actually slowing down things is very important. Otherwise we run into dangers. And this is something I've been sort of learning about, but I know you have to go. So we're going to have to come back and maybe have another conversation, maybe in a few months time, or, you know, whenever you can make it, and we can talk about more products that you think are exciting, and, you know, and we'll have a recap and see what's happened, because everything's moving very quickly right now in the way I see it. And it's kind of very exciting, to be honest. I'm just hoping, like you are, that we can sort of galvanize these relationships with other countries and other continents, and really build some sustainability into the world and calm everything down, you know. And hopefully that will happen at some point. I mean, it's very difficult. Everyone gets triggered by all sorts of information these days, and that's half of the battle, isn't it, at the end of the day?
Yeah, and I think it's one of those weird things of I didn't really understand or get excited about history, particularly when I was a kid at school, because it was often framed in, you need to learn these dates, you need to learn these people and what happened and the treaty of whatever. And yet the irony is, increasingly, I spend a huge amount of time going back through historic things to try and understand what are the universal truths about our humanity in order to sort of go, yeah, we're probably going to react that way to it. You know, and I find it funny that in one of the write-ups I did on Right to Repair, as much as I'm a huge fanboy of Charlie Brooker, I made the point that there was a film called The Man in the White Suit in 1950 or 1951, which I think was kind of the original Black Mirror. It was the original sort of tech, you know, sort of fable. But actually, when you look at the narrative arc and the way it was put together, it was so Charlie Brooker that essentially this scientist develops a suit that is essentially never needs to be washed. It never breaks. It never tears. It never goes wrong. And the company becomes millionaires in year one. But of course, in year two, no one needs to buy another suit. So therein play out the chaos that ensues. And the spoiler is that actually people are relieved that it has a defect in it, and eventually everything goes back the way it was. And, you know, blessed is our consumerism and capitalism. So I think, you know, I know I said I'm an optimist, but I think one of the hardest shifts, I think, for brands and companies now is to redefine what it is that people value. Because at the minute, we're still living off a madman of Madison Avenue, you know, Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays. We're still living off this thing of keeping up with the Joneses and very deep, complex insecurities. We're not transitioning to a point of where enough is enough. And I don't mean enough as in just food, but I mean enough as in we consider ourselves enough. We don't have to keep putting another stone on the cairn of improving ourselves in some sort of endless self-help book race to what exactly. So I think that's going to be one of the really catch-22 problems I think a lot of companies have to work with, is how do we create more wholesome interactions with consumerism, and can it be reduced while still being profitable for companies? You know, and I would like to think those are the projects that I'm contributing to with the clients that I'm working on, which of course I can't say much about, sadly. But those are the sorts of questions which, for me, I shouldn't say it, but I'd work on them for free, because I absolutely right. love the ethical direction of where it's going, but it's tempered by the stone cold business reality of, one of my friends, Andrew Carr, says even a sustainable business needs to be sustainable, implying financially as well. So these are the sort of conundrums I love. And I think the only way we really understand it, and kind of stealing from Lego here, is you only understand it whether you build it, play with it, learn from it, interact with it. So this is why I think the prototyping of it is king.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And things do make sense in the rearview mirror, which is why we get into the history of everything. So thank you, Jude. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you want to check out Jude's website, it's judepullen.com. And I will drop a link to that somewhere for you. And do let us know if there are any topics you want to talk about next time. And we can drop those in. So thank you very much for listening. Share this with your friends.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thanks.